Today's Teisho is on case 34 in the Hekigan Roku, the Pien Lu. Case 34 is entitled, Kyozans, You Have Not Visited Rozan. Main subject, Kyozan asked a monk, where are you from? Mount Rozan, answered the monk. Have you ever visited Goroho Peak? Asked Kyozan. No, not yet, said the monk. Kyozan said, you have not visited Rozan. Later, Umon said, this talk of Kyozan's was falling into the weeds all out of kindness. Secho's verse, falling or not falling, who can tell? White clouds piling up, under a white clouds piling up, bright sun shining down. Faultless the left, mature the right. Don't you know Kanzan? He went very fast, 10 years not returning. He forgot the way he had come. So today is the third day of our January session, and the sitting has been really wonderful. Really. Last night, people came into Dokusan, and everybody was practicing very deeply, and it was really impressive, really gratifying. A number of you have been practicing for some time. And, you know, after many years of practice, people begin to develop real wisdom. And so when people come in working on their koans, sometimes they give answers that are really beautiful answers. And it's really wonderful to see people who have worked on themselves, worked on their minds, and are able to be really awake. And so, you know, I don't think the teacher makes this happen. I think that the teacher's job is to be like a coach, right? You know, you encourage people and you help them with their, you know, their day-to-day struggles. But really, it's the big mind that brings it all together. And it's really marvelous to see it all coming together so beautifully. You know, when everybody's just doing a great job. It's very gratifying. And sometimes people give answers, and I just think, geez, I wish I could have. That's a really good answer. I wish I gave that answer, you know. Answering koans is not about coming up with a good answer. It's about learning how to be really empty and simple. You know, and it's very, very hard to be simple. Very, very difficult. When we're growing up, part of identity formation is learning how to be different from other people. And this is like complexity, right? Learning how to complicate yourself. I know that, my brother and I had a tense relationship when we were growing up. And we were often rivals. You know, my brother and I became rivals, and I didn't know how it happened, but we were very competitive. And You know, if I said the sky was blue, my brother would disagree with me. He'd say, no, it's gray. Or it seemed like everything I did, my brother disagreed and wanted to do differently, you know. And I couldn't understand it. We had a lot of quarrels. And then I realized growing up that my brother was trying to be a person, you know. So he was a person by not being like me, you know. This was one of the ways he became a person, was by being different from Kurt. And this is very human, you know, very human. My brother had two children, a boy and a girl, and they had intense rivalries, you know. My brother said that, you know, they would, if one child would say, I like hamburgers, the other child would say, oh, I hate hamburgers, you know. And sometimes, if they were on a long trip, my brother would actually, in his car, he had a very fancy car, because he was a businessman, he had like a BMW. And in a BMW, unlike normal people's cars, there's a, in the middle of the seat, in the back, there's a divider that folds down. So it's like an extra armrest, because if you paid $60,000 for a car, you should be able to rest your arms wherever you're sitting. Right? So there's an armrest in the middle of the back seat, and my brother put it down, and he put one child over here, and he put the other child over here, and he put the armrest in the middle so they wouldn't be bickering. And he said he looked back there at one point, and they both had their arms on the armrest, and they were pushing each other, trying to push each other off the armrest, and his daughter, who was a few years younger than his son, had her feet against the door. She was using it for leverage. Right? Now, a lot of this has to do with becoming a person. You know, this is when I was young, very young, you know, most people when they're 12, 11 or 12, they really aren't people yet. You know, they really aren't. I mean, they should be treated with respect, but they really aren't humans yet, you know, not totally. They're pretending to be humans. They're learning how to be human, you know. So, you know, when the Beatles came out, all my friends had to have Beatle haircuts, you know. And if your parents wouldn't let you have a Beatles haircut, it was like a death sentence, right, you know. I mean, I remember my father wouldn't let us have Beatles haircuts, and my brother was so agonized by this. And of course, the kids who came on the bus with Beatles haircuts had really made it. You know, it was like, my God, you know, he's really it, you know. And these stupid haircuts, you know, they're straight, your hair is cut straight across your forehead, hangs down over your forehead, and it's cut straight across, like somebody put a bowl over your head and just trimmed it, you know. But it was the coolest thing in the world, and this is all part of becoming a human being, right? You know, you need to be different from others in order to be real to yourself. You know, so it's complicated because you also have to be different from others in ways they'll respect, you know. So having, you know, when I grew up, the ordinary haircut was like an Elvis Presley haircut, you know. So it was parted on the side, and you could have it sort of flipped up in the front, right? And where I was living at the time was in the South, so there were actually people who would sort of like put a little hair oil in their hair. It was really grotesque, but it was important. That was how people looked. And then when the Beatles came along, it was very important not to look like that, but to look like Ringo Starr, you know. All of this goes on all the time on many different levels, where we want to be real, And we learn how to be a person through these complex relationships with others. And it's a combination of imitation and sort of like rebellion, you know. My brother was always trying to be different from me. I was a really pathetic geek. You know, I was when I was young, I really wasn't athletic at all. I was very thin and scrawny, and I had a bad complexion. And there was nothing I could do to be special except try to be smart, you know. And so I realized that I could, you know, I liked to read, and if I tried, I could get good grades, you know. So I actually studied really hard and got, you know, very, very good grades all the time. And then people would say, "Oh, that Kurt, he's really smart." And I felt like I had arrived, you know. I felt like I had made it. Because now I had something that made me special. I was the smart one. And my brother, on the other hand, he went out for football. And he was really too small to play football. But he eventually became like the hippie in his high school. And he had this incredible musical collection, and he knew all the rock bands, and he was like an expert on rock music. So I was the square, the guy who was a nerd and a geek. And Peter was the cool one who knew all the hip music, you know. And sometimes I would ask him about a record, and I would get the name of the rock group wrong, and he'd laugh. He'd have such a good time about that, right? It wasn't I think malicious laughter. It just meant, you know, boy, I've really succeeded in being a person. You know, you don't know anything about rock music, you know. And later, of course, I became sort of a hippie too. And I guess that worried my brother in some ways, because I was stealing his identity. But these kinds of things go on all the time. And it doesn't stop when we're adults, you know. We're constantly in this complex relationship with other people, trying to be like them, but also trying to be different enough to be real. And this can become like a never-ending struggle, right? Every once in a while, something will happen to us that complicates this, you know? So, for example, you sometimes find that deep inside yourself, there's something you need to do, you know, that you need to do. It's something you want to do, that you need to do. And it might not be approved of by other people. And this happens to people sometimes very late in life and sometimes very early in life. You know, and when it happens, it can create a real crisis, you know. Because it might be the first time in your life when instead of playing this game of identity and rebellion, in order to be a person, you're like drawing your identity from a different place, you know. People had to wear, when I was young, when I was in college, everybody had to have bell bottoms and blue jeans, and everybody had longish hair, you know, depending on how cool you want it to be. Your hair could be very long or somewhat long. I was reading the other day that like 3/4 of the undergraduate class at Harvard is going into finance. You know. Now, is that because everybody's interested in money and finances and economic theory? I don't think so. I think there's a kind of group think going on, right? On the other hand, there's always the English major who says, well, I'm not going to be like that. You know, those guys are, you know. So people define themselves sometimes by looking at what everybody else is doing, and they decide, I want to be like this, but I also need to be different in some way, you know. But there's another element in life, and that's where somehow inside yourself a kind of energy gathers. You know, a kind of energy gathers, or force gathers, and it becomes a powerful voice in your life. And this is different from that other kind of identity, right? Something inside you speaks, and it may not be what you want to hear. You know, it may not be what we want to hear. You know, a friend of mine for many years is a gay person, and he and I have a similar background of being in like a military brats. You know, so. We grew up in a hyper macho environment, right? And I myself didn't fit because I was not athletic and I was scrawny, and so when I looked at like sailors, you know, Navy men, I never thought to myself, gee, I want to be one of those guys. In fact, all I could think of was, how do I get out of here? You know? And being a good student, like being the smart one, was like my ticket out of that world. But my friend, who's much smarter than I am, as a matter of fact, you know, he had this secret. He was gay. And it wasn't until he got to college. And even then, it took a long time for him to come to terms with this aspect of himself. And years later, he told me that at various times in his life, he actually thought of killing himself. You know, but you know, there was a voice inside of him that was speaking powerfully, telling him that this is something he had to follow this road, or at least explore this road. And of course, that's very, very difficult when all the messages of a culture are telling you something very different, you know. It helps knowing other people who have gone down that road and can be like mentors, you know. Somebody who's been down that road and can say, well, you know, here's how you can navigate all of this. You know. But he didn't have a mentor. He was very isolated on this military base, and I had to struggle with a lot of shame and fear and so on. But this is a different kind of thing, right? It's like I have friends who are artists, you know, and they sometimes had parents who said, artist, you know, are you out of your ever-loving mind, you know? And they decided, you know, to listen to that voice and follow that road, you know. And in many cases it hasn't been easy for them, you know. So, you know, my brother-in-law is really a very good artist, really quite talented. And he has had to do his artwork and also make a living. And the way he has done that is to make this beautiful furniture. I've mentioned him before, I think. If you ever go online and you look at John Sutman, you'll see his furniture, which is quite amazing. And he does his sculpture, but he also makes this incredible designer furniture, which is a kind of sculpture in itself. It's really pretty amazing. And they sell for fantastic amounts of money. So, you know, basically some of these things sell for $30,000, so it's half a BMW, in other words. So, he's had a struggle in life, but he's been, in Zen we would say he's been true to his true self. You know, and so the Zen way of living is to listen to that deeper voice, And it's not always something we want to hear, you know. And it can create, in fact, a lot of Zen practice is learning how to hear that voice and learning how to be true to that voice, you know. And sometimes the voice is telling us things we just don't want to hear. We just don't want to hear it. And we don't trust it, you know, we don't trust it. Because, you know, you might be in a job where you have a good paycheck every 2 weeks, and you hate your job, and you have this other desire to maybe do something very different, you know. You can squelch that voice, but that often creates a lot of unexamined conflicts and tensions. Eventually maybe you become very unhappy or very, very unbalanced. And you might come into a Zen center and try meditation. And as I often say, you know, sitting on the cushion is not just about bliss. You know, so many people come into, there's a whole world out there of people who want to practice yoga and meditation so that they can have a blissful life. But Zen is a little more, I think, mature than that. Because it says, look, you know, you're going to have to listen to that inner voice. You're also going to have to confront, like, there might be a shadow inside you, you know. In other words, there's something we don't want to see, and there's something that is frightening us, you know. And so, koans, when we do koan practice, we're sometimes working through some of these obstacles, something we don't want to see, or something where, you know, we confront a kind of fear we've kept locked up inside ourselves. And it can be tremendously liberating when we find out that that there's this energy inside ourselves that we can trust. You know, that there's this energy inside ourselves that we can trust. It takes a lot of sitting and a lot of courage to get in touch with that energy, you know. We're afraid. I mean, we're afraid, and also we also have learned to draw our identity from, you know, what other people do and tell us to do and so on. You know, you'll sometimes meet people who are very, very indecisive people, you know. One week they decide they want to be a lawyer. And as soon as they make the decision to be a lawyer, they start worrying about it, right? And they get very nervous and think, well, you know, maybe I'm not making the right decision. And then they start obsessing about whether it's the right decision or not. And then, you know, they go to law school, and they're in law school, and all the time they're in law school, they're thinking, gee, I wonder if I've made the right decision. Now maybe I should have gone into the academic world, you know. This is like having a double mind, right? It's like when you're in the South, you think maybe you'd be better off in the North. When you're in the North, you wish you were in the West, right? And you have doubts about being in the North. This is very common. This kind of ambivalence is very common. It's actually almost everybody feels this ambivalence all the time, you know, about everything they do. But every once in a while, we're doing something wholeheartedly. It can be a struggle to do something wholeheartedly because, you know, it sometimes puts us at odds with parents, society, the lessons we learned in growing up. And of course, if you get off the beaten path a little bit, you are going to make mistakes. And then you'll look back and think, oh, if only I had stayed on the regular road, you know. But, you know, when we do that, we don't realize that all those people on that regular road are saying, why did I choose this road, you know? Why didn't I step off, you know? Zen is really about getting in touch with this deep, we say true nature. And there is ultimately no self. At the center of yourself is like mu. But that doesn't mean you don't have a conditional self, you know. While you're alive, you're a person, you know. The energy has come together to create you. This primal energy of nothingness has come together to create you, and you have a life, you know. And sometimes, if we're lucky, we get in touch with this kind of energy in ourselves that's really quite thrilling. It comes from breaking free from false expectations and these mental structures. And it's like being reborn, or it's like being a natural person, you know. I remember going, the first time I went backpacking was with a Boy Scout troop that my father was a scoutmaster of. And we had a miserable time, actually, because my father didn't really understand that on our base, he got military packs. These are World War II backpacks that were designed for GIs. And Mr. Sayre, the other scoutmaster, had been in the war, and Mr. Sayre had been in the army, so he had worn one of these packs. And they basically planned the outing, which was to be a 50-mile hike. We were going to do 10 miles a day. They planned the outing by buying things like bags of potatoes, canned food, things in cans, you know. And they knew nothing of what they were doing, you know. So they came up with these packs that were 50 or 60 pounds, you know. Because, you know, in the army, that's how you used to travel. You had, like, K rations. And indeed, we had K rations in our pack. We had eggs. You know, they packed eggs. They packed loaves of bread. It was just crazy. They had learned this in the military, you know. We were, like, 10 and 11 years old. And, you know, anybody who knew anything about this would have said, you can't put a 60-pound pack on a kid who weighs 60 pounds. But they did it. And we went up into the mountains, and we were supposed to cover 10 miles, and I think we did about 2.5, 3 miles, you know. And then they were looking for water, because we had to camp, but we needed water because we had been drinking all our water. And we were all these little kids who had lived on like the base in like a suburban environment. And we had a miserable time. I remember these kids were crying. At the end of the day, people were sobbing with exhaustion. And we did a couple days like this, and then I remember, we tossed a lot of the cans, or we left them in, by the trail, and we tossed the loaves of bread in the latrine and things like that. Only the bigger kids finished that hike that time. The next time we did it a little smarter, but. The thing is, being out there in that environment was truly thrilling for me. You know, like most kids, I had spent my life watching television. And to be out in this place where, you know, it was very hot during the day, there were bugs, you know, and we slept on the floor. You know, by all rights, you know, it should have been a miserable, hellish experience. And I think for many of the kids, it was, you know. I remember a kid named Eddie O'Connor, who had been crying earlier, and I remember he was lying in his sleeping bag, and he had a big bag of candies that he was eating before he went to bed. He was comforting himself with candy, you know, and wishing he were back at home watching television. And indeed, he never came for another hike. But it was beautiful. It was like something inside me lit up, you know. And I've had similar experiences, you know. The first time I think I saw Impressionist painting, I just thought, holy crap, what is this, you know? And I had that feeling when I saw Georgia O'Keeffe's work, you know. And I had that feeling, you know, in my travels various times, you know. And I had that feeling when I started doing Zen, you know. It was just like, holy crap, what is this? You know, and there's this energy that when you go into deep mushin, sometimes there's this life energy. And so the Zen path is living in touch with that life energy. And it's not like something we can use to do whatever we want. That would be a misunderstanding. It's not like a Red Bull energy drink, right? You know, so you can have a Red Bull energy drink with a million milligrams of caffeine, and you can, do something extraordinary. You can stay up all night. Zen is not like that, because you can't use it to do anything. You can only use it to do good things, as a matter of fact. You can only use it to do things that are basically good for you, actually. So learning how to do Zen is tricky, because Zen isn't like finding this energy source that you can command, right? It's not like that. The first time you're in Mu and you begin to experience this deep energy, it's quite thrilling. But it's not like a technology that you can command. It's when you find that energy, you have to be the servant of the energy. It's like you have to be the servant of the energy. So it's not your tool. It's, in a way you could say, it's your master. You know, this is quite important. So you can't really use that energy to beat somebody up. You know, if you stay with that energy and you're sitting on the cushion and you decide you're going to beat somebody up, you'll find the energy abandons you. And if you're you might wonder, where has the energy gone, you know, sometimes in your practice? And there are waves, you know, so sometimes the energy is there very strongly and sometimes it goes away, like the tide. So it has its own mysterious, the Tao has its own mystery. It comes when it comes and it goes when it goes. Sometimes if we can't get in touch with the energy, it's because what we want is not good for us. You know, actually, it's like our deeper mind is saying, wait a minute, you're not being true to your true nature. And it can be rather frustrating sometimes, right? So sitting on the cushion is like a school for getting in touch with that energy and then learning how to be the servant of that energy. And sometimes the energy can be telling us to do things our little mind doesn't want to do, and we feel very uncomfortable. And that can create quite a struggle in our life. You know, it can create quite a struggle. But if you've been the servant of the energy long enough, you become very simple. You know, you don't cling so much to the small self, and you live in the bigger self. And you become the servant of that energy, and you do what the energy tells you to do. Now, it could take a long time before you trust the energy. You know, that's a big problem in Zen, is learning how to trust the energy. As soon as we trust the energy, we become simple. And as soon as we doubt the energy, everything becomes hopelessly complicated and impossible. Right? It's like suddenly everything becomes impossible. But trusting the energy, and also, you know, even in the case of advanced practitioners, people can, you know, sometimes lose confidence in them, in the energy. You know, you can think, well, how did I wind up here? You know, maybe I shouldn't have listened to that inner voice, you know. That's the struggle for advanced practitioners. You know, even a very advanced person can have that tension. And people are always just human, you know. Years ago, I learned that Maizumi Roshi, the Roshi at the Los Angeles Zen Center, had a drinking problem. And I thought to myself, gee, that's really, he's really phony, you know. And then I met many of his students, and they were deeply in love with him, and they knew he had a drinking problem. Let me just say, I don't have a drinking problem, so that's not where this is going. But the point was that, you know, he still had karma to clean up, and even very advanced practitioners, you know, this was a man who probably worked 80 hours a week, every week, and died when he was 64. So I think he pushed himself very hard. He did his bodhisattva thing in a very diligent way, he built a very large Zen center, being a human being, sometimes the pressures got the better of him. But he didn't quit, you know, because he was still being true to his true nature. He was being true to those energies. And even though he had, the tension got to him sometime, and that might be shocking to think about, but, you know, if you work 80 hours a week every week and you never take vacations and so on, sometimes you get very worn down, you know. That happened to Genki too, you know, sometimes. Both of them continued. They didn't lose faith in their true nature, and they kept trust with that energy, and it all worked out, you know, really beautifully. But there are going to be moments in every life where people say, why did I trust this energy? Okay. Don't lose confidence in it. Kyozans, you have not visited Rozan. Let me just say that Rozan is the Japanese word for one of the five sacred Buddhist mountains in China. There are mountains like Emeshan, where, and in fact Rozan, I can't remember which one it is, but there's mountains like Emeshan, which are historically sacred mountains in the Buddhist community, and they're loaded with temples, you know. At various times in Buddhist history, these mountains have been like covered with temples. And Emeshan suffered during the Red Guard period, but now there's a bunch of temples up there, and statue of Samantabhadra, and so on and so on. So it's actually like a big tourist stop now. But it's quite beautiful. And people used to make pilgrimages there to do some meditation at the temples, and monks and nuns lived there and practiced. So it was a place where many people went to do practice. And so Kyoza asked the monk, "Where are you from?" And the monk says, "I'm from Mount Rozan. I'm from Mount Emeshan," asked the monk. And he said, "Oh, that's great. You live in that sacred mountain." And he says, "Have you ever visited Goroho Peak?" And this is like at the top or near the top, there's this peak which is very majestic and bare. You know, it's like stone, big stone peak. He says, "Have you ever visited there?" And the monk says, "No, not yet." "Oh, not yet." Kyozan said, "Then you haven't visited Mount Emeshan. You haven't, until you've gotten to the peak, you haven't really been to the sacred mountain." And later, Umon said, "This talk of Kyozan's was falling into the weeds out of kindness." I'm looking forward to doing this koan with everybody here. But basically, this koan is about trusting that energy, trusting your true nature. And so, you know, it's one thing to go to the sacred mountain where everybody goes. But it's another thing to be in touch with the peak. You know, it's another thing to be in touch with that energy. That's sort of what the koan is getting at. You know, we have to go to the real heart of Zen is not sitting on the cushion in a certain way. You know, if you go to some Zen centers, it's very formalistic, you know. Everything has to be done exactly right. They put a lot of emphasis on, you know, when you take your bowls apart, you put the chopsticks in a certain place, and everybody's always worried about making a mistake, you know. And it's easy to make the false assumption that Zen is about, being tight-assed, basically. Like tight-assed. You have to really dot the I's and you cross the T's. But I think that's a big mistake, you know. Zen is about being in touch with that energy and being the servant of that energy. And you have, that takes a lot of courage, and it's not without conflicts, right? You have to work through a lot of like inner conflicts. So here's Secho's verse: "Falling or not falling, who can tell? White clouds piling up, bright sun shining down." You have, you know, life is the clouds. You know, are you on the way up? Or are you on the way down? Are you succeeding or are you failing? You know, who can tell? Success and failure, gain and loss, right and wrong, these are relative terms. They're not really meaningful. You have the sun piling, you have the clouds piling up against the mountains, but the bright sun is also falling down. This is life, right? And so he said, then they say, don't you know Kanzan? Don't you know Hanshan? This is Hanshan from our lineage. Don't you know Hanshan? He went very fast. 10 years not returning. He forgot the way he had come. Hanshan went up to the peak. Now Hanshan is the man after whom our lineage is named, was a government bureaucrat. And then he quit and he became a monk. And then he quit being a monk and he went up to live in the mountains among the clouds. And he said, you know, the clouds are my blanket and the ground is my bed. And he lived up there and wrote these beautiful poems on like scraps of, on like the back of leaves and things like that, you know. And they were later collected and there are these incredibly beautiful poems. But the thing is that, you know, Hanshan was a lunatic in some ways, you know. He lived on this mountain and, you know, he had tattered clothes and he was, you know, really nuts, you know, in a certain way. But on the other hand, he lived deeply in touch with that energy, you know, deeply in touch with that energy. And so, you know, basically he didn't worry about things like gain and loss, right and wrong. He was being true to that energy. That's the ordinary person is you know, oblivious a lot of the time to that energy. Unusual person is aware of the energy. A more unusual person is the servant of that energy. And then sometimes there are people who are like real bodhisattvas who are like Hanshan, who really dedicate themselves to that energy in like an unquestioning way. You know, so we're all working working to find the energy, to be the servant of the energy, and then to be like true to that energy to various degrees, you know. But when you meet people like, you know, when you meet really, there are people on earth who are quite remarkable in how fully they trust that energy. Even like the Dalai Lama, and in the Zen tradition, there are such people too. So anyway, let's get in touch with that energy, and be the servant of that energy today, and let it heal us, and transform us, and make our lives more alive, more beautiful. Okay.